We're going to continue here with the theme that we started off in the first hour of the program, and that is books. And if you weren't listening or you haven't heard these programs we've done, the idea is that every once in a while we have guests who come into the studio and we just say to them, tell us about something that you have read lately that you just thought was really good and that you think other people might enjoy too. It could be fiction, it could be nonfiction, it could be whatever. It doesn't necessarily even have to be something new, although I think part of the idea is, yes, we're talking about books that have been recently published. That's the kind of thing. And we also tell people who are listening that, hey, you want to do the same? You can do that as well. And we've swapped out the guests. Now we have two brand new, fresh guests here for this part of the show, Gail Walden and Carol Spindell. And they're both writers and both teachers of writing. They both taught creative writing. Gail is a published poet. She's written stories. You have a novel, right?
In hasn't my desk yet drawer.
The Great American Novels in her desk drawer. Yeah. She has also done journalistic writing and has taught creative writing here at the University of Illinois. Carol, her books include Dancing at Halftime and The Sacred Grove. And she also has been a teacher of writing. And both of them do a lot of reading. And that's what we look for, people who are enthusiastic about books, who do teaching and who do reviewing and who do writing and who work in the world of books. And they agreed to come on and say, yeah, we'll talk with you for a little while. And they brought some books with them to recommend. They will be on our website, so if you have web access, you can get to Adam that way. And questions are welcome, too, from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if you want to call in. And thanks to both of you very much for being here.
Delighted to be here.
I don't know who wants to go first. And we could toss a coin or just...
Well, I'll be glad to go first.
Okay. Carol, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't have any recent books to start with, but I thought it might be kind of fun to bring in pairs of books because sometimes it's more interesting to read a book in juxtaposition to another book. And that's kind of a fun thing for a book club to do, especially if the books are short, they don't take that long to read them both. And the kind of edges where they bump up against each other, that creates a kind of interesting place for discussion, I think. And I've done that a lot with my students. So I have, first of all, two memoirs. They are both older memoirs. The one I recommend that you read first for this little experiment is called Autobiography of a Face. It's by Lucy Greeley. It's very, very well known, actually, so it's not overlooked. A beautiful first book by a poet, the story of her struggle to live with jaw cancer, had cancer of the face and jaw as a child, and then had to live with that. And then I always ask my students about a memoir, okay, but does this spiral out to larger meaning? Does it go beyond this person's life? And this book, I think, really definitely does because it sort of spirals out to that larger subject of how very important appearance is in our society. Mm-hmm. Now, if you buy a newer version of Lucy Greeley's book, like a paperback, it may have in the back an afterword by Ann Patchett. Now, my advice is don't read it. Read the Lucy Greeley book and then leave the afterword alone, and then read Ann Patchett's memoir, where she's going to tell the same story. She was Lucy Greeley's friend, and she's going to now tell her side of their friendship. And that's called Truth and Beauty of Friendship. And if you know Ann Patchett, she's a novelist. This is her first book of nonfiction. It's beautifully written. They were students together first, I believe it was at Sarah Lawrence, and then at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. They became very, very close friends. I mean, their relationship is it's nice to see women's friendship depicted in this way, more important than a love relationship, I think. And after you've read the two, I think you'll see that there are a lot of differences. They're very different people, and they tell the story very differently. Then, if you want to add a third note into this little choral thing you have going, I can put on the web, there's an essay by Lucy's twin sister, who also adds her her voice and disagrees and feels has strong feelings about Ann Patchett writing this book about her sister. So those three pieces together, I think, make a really interesting reading.
Oh, that is interesting because there's, I suppose, when you're reading a memoir, there's always this question that, well, yeah, you're getting the version of this person's life that they would like you to have, which may have truth in it, but then again, you have to wonder, well, are you getting the straight story from this person? So at least this gives you another, there's no guarantee that anybody else is going to give you the straight story either, but I suppose it's the straight story according to me.
Right. I guess that's what I'd say. There is no straight story. We all go around in blinkers. We all see only, you know, that little narrow space in front of us. So to see three different people whose spaces overlap is just really, I think, interesting.
Yeah, all right. Very good. Well, Gail, give us one of your selections.
Okay. Well, I do have a couple contemporary books or recently I reviewed for the Chicago Sun-Times, and so I was going to talk about those.
Sure.
But I wanted to first do a memorandum of Grace Paley because that's my favorite part of the Oscars. And I think that the book recommendation section should have a memorandum. Grace Paley died in August of this year, and she had a very small body of work, but she was influential for many, I think, women writers, especially.
Absolutely.
Of, like, Carol and my generation. And her sentences are very compact, and they add up to something. And I was just going to read the very beginning of one of my favorite of her short stories, which is called Once. I saw my ex-husband in the street. I was sitting on the steps of the new library. "Hello, my life," I said. We had once been married for 27 years, so I felt justified. He said, "What? What life? No life of mine." I said, "Okay. I don't argue when there's a real disagreement." I got up and went into the library to see how much I owed them. The librarian said $32 even, and you've owed it for 18 years. I didn't deny anything, because I don't understand how time passes. I have had those books. I have often thought of them. The library is only two blocks away. My ex-husband followed me to the book's return desk. He interrupted the librarian, who had more to tell. "In many ways," he said, "as I look back, I attribute the dissolution to our marriage to the fact that you never invited the Bertrams to dinner."
So tell me some more about what you like about Grace Paley.
The absolute sparseness of her writing, and that she was, and that she wrote so little and became so influential to people. I think she was at a time when women writers weren't very much the norm. I sort of put her and Tilly Olson together. I don't
Absolutely.
Know if you do that, too.
Absolutely.
But, and she became a political activist. She was in New York, I think, all of her life. And into raising children and fighting against the war were, you know, writing wasn't her most prominent thing in her life, I think. And I like that
right.
about her, too.
Mm-hmm. And it's all there in the stories, and the stories she's trying to make ends meet. She's protesting and out, you know, picketing for racial justice. She's raising children. She's taking care of elderly relatives. I mean, it's all there. This sort of nitty-gritty of a woman's life is just in those stories.
Carol and I were talking. I have the book Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, but there has been a recently, in April, released collected short stories of Grace Paley, which I think is only 300 pages, and I think that's all she wrote, pretty much. I think there's a new poetry book coming out. But I often buy my books at used bookstores, and there's an inscription. Grace Paley has signed this book to Cheryl Grace Paley, and then at the bottom, with apologies.
You're asking, what was this all about?
Because
you have no idea.
But did she sign the with apologies? Did the person who sold it to the used bookstore feel obligated to say, "Sorry, I'm selling"?
Maybe she was apologizing to Grace Paley. "Sorry, I had to sell your book."
But this sort of segues into a more recent book that I was going to talk about, and that is The Used World by Haven Kimmel. And it's a trilogy. It's a third of a trilogy of place, she says, and that's in Indiana. And it's a fictional town between Jonah, Indiana, a college town, in Haiti, and an old farming town that is one of those farming towns that used to have farmers and good Victorian houses and is now being torn down for trailer parks. And where everybody's stuff goes is into this thrift shop called the Used World Emporium. And people's lives sort of filter in through objects and objects that other people live in. The novel follows three women, Hazel, Claudia, and Rebecca. Hazel is an older woman who's the owner of a used world emporium. Hazel has a vague sort of psychic gift which she feels gives her credentials to interfere in other people's lives, or at least the narratives of their lives. It is Hazel who supplies most of the plot points. If Hazel dressed in orange batik and blinking Christmas earrings, it is noticed. Hazel has less a sense of style than affinity for catastrophe. And I really liked this novel because it was really smart. And I think it's hard to find a novel that's it's both entertaining and smart. And it deals with religion, and it deals with abortion, and it deals with a lot of things that contemporary novels don't seem to deal with in an entertaining way. You know, mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. they segregate out into nonfiction, basically. Yeah. So.
All right. So again, good. tell the title and the author.
Haven Kimmel is the author, and the title is The Used World, and it's by Free Press, and it was just released last month.
Okay. And again, if people are interested in the writers and in the titles, we'll have them on our website so that if you do have web access, you can go to will.illinois.edu and go to the Focus 580 section. The information will be there. Okay. And as I've said before, if somebody wants to call in and tell us about a book, they can do that. Carol, you were talking earlier about the memoirs. There seems to be, just within the last, I don't know how many years, just it's this explosion of memoirs. I'm not sure why exactly. They must be selling books or else the publishers wouldn't publish them. Why do you think that is? And maybe the further question, which in a sense you answered, why really would you want to read the story of another person's life? If it was your aunt, well, okay, maybe you would say, yes, I'd like to know this. But if this is somebody that you don't know at all, why would you say, well, why would I want to read this?
I think it's a really interesting question, David. You know, why is our society at this point in time turning away from fiction? The novel has always been the dominant American literary form since World War II. It hasn't always been. I mean, if we went back earlier to the time of Thoreau and Emerson, we would find, you know, a very dominant strain of nonfiction. But if we're looking at post-World War II, it's been the novel. And that's changed. And I think part of that has to do with the different way that we view history now. Because when I went to school and I studied history, history was done by, you know, great men. They're usually white, too. But, you know, those were the only guys in the history books, the generals up on their horses, the presidents. Nobody else was really in history books. And then the civil rights era came along, feminism came along, and this concept of social history came along. And there came this idea that any person's life, even a child's life, even looking at childhood or looking at, you know, a woman who was a cleaning woman in a kitchen, that any person's life would give you insights into that society and that was all part of the fabric of history. And I think that historical view kind of floated over into literature. Now, and it's happened really quickly, because when I submitted my first book, which was a memoir, in 1984, one rejection letter, I had 13 from pretty much every major house in the country. And of course, eventually, if you're a writer listening out there, take heart. It did get published and became a New York Times notable book, so there was hope. But one of these rejection letters said, well, you're not an anthropologist, so you can't write a book about Africa. So at that time, to write nonfiction, you had to have professional expertise. You had to have, like, degrees. And you're not famous, so you can't write a memoir. So memoirs in that era, even just such a short time ago, were written by famous people. Or if you weren't famous, you had lived in proximity to fame or great events. You could be the wife of a famous scientist and write about it, like Oppenheimer's wife wrote. You could be the cook in the White House, you know, and write about what you saw going on in the halls. But you had to at least have proximity to big events or famous people. And that has just totally changed. It's actually not that easy to get a literary memoir published these days, and it's really not that different from literary fiction in that regard, that it is hard. There are a lot of them, and they have to really reach they have to reach beyond, you know, your aunt's story. But there's a whole another world of people writing memoirs for each other, I think, in families and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really wonderful, too, that all this stuff is getting written down.
And it seems like every once in a while, one of those books, I'm just thinking, I read something about the other day about a woman having written a book about her experiences as a Mormon woman who was in a multiple marriage where she was married to a guy and had only two wives. And the story was that she just basically wrote that book for her children and grandchildren because she wanted them to know what her life had been. But it got published and it's sold hugely. So every once in a while, one of those, something about that person's life is going to grab people.
And she could have written it as a novel, but I think there's so much deception and distortion going on in our world now. Why don't we want a novel? I think we're always asking, how did this novelist get the legitimacy, get this experience? Do they really know what they're talking about? And we're very skeptical these days of information and the media and something that's entertaining. I think we're really afraid. Who should we trust? Mm. And so a memoir has this kind of shaky, handheld quality, like a home movie. And we think, okay, this is real. I can trust this. Now, that may be an illusion, but I think it's the feeling of many readers.
Yeah, you were going to say, Gail, you were going to say something. You were leaning towards the microphone.
yeah, that was a minute ago. But I think we know that there's this multiplicity of lives now because we're so connected through internet and stuff, but we don't know the details about them. I think that we see other people. And I can actually talk about this other book in connection with that a little bit, which is sort of a memoir, but he has a project around the memoir, and it's called The Year of Living Biblically. And I think this is happening, too. I think people are having informational books merged into memoir.
And this, we should talk about this a second, because I know this book has just come out.
Oh, yeah.
And the premise is that you have a guy who just said, okay, what would happen if you took all the things in the Bible about how it is, you know, how you were supposed to live, and you actually tried to do that?
Right. He finds 800 rules, some of which he cannot do because they involve plucking out your eye or something like that. But he tries to, if it's completely figurative, clearly he tries not to do it. But if it's literal, he tries to abide by it. He tries to stone an adulterer. And he finds out that, I mean, by reading the book, you find out about all these communities that exist in the religious communities, like snake handlers in Georgia. And he thinks there's a command not to have mixed fibers in your suit. So he thinks, well, who's gonna be able to tell me if my suits are of mixed fibers? But in fact, as he calls around, there's, you know, a guy whose job it is to go into people's closets and take out the mixed fibers, which, by the way, is not polyester. It's like it has to be linen and wool. That's the only thing you can't mix. And it has to do with, well, Arabs. And it has to do with some group of people not supposing to mix in their clothing. Everything, it's very interesting in that. But in this, it's also a memoir. He's trying to have a second child, and his marriage gets affected by him living biblically. You know, things happen in his life also as he goes along in this year.
All right.
It's kind
this
of
is
mixed
a book
genre.
That it's The Year of Living Biblically, and it just came out.
I just reviewed it in last week's Sun Times, and there's actually that in there, and it's been reviewed every place. It's gotten a lot of publicity, I think.
I think I've seen an ad, and I guess it's the author, and he's like wearing sandals or something.
Looking,
and has long hair.
Yeah,
well,
looking,
he grows a beard. Yeah, yeah. He can't shave for a year, and he starts to dress in white, which is an ecclesiastic command. And he stops eating animal products completely because it's too hard to figure out which ones to eat or which ones not to. And
so that sounds really interesting.
Our guests here in this part of Focus 580, Gail Walden and Carol Spindell, and this is one of those book shows we do at time to time. We invite guest into the studio and say, well, tell us about what you've been reading lately. Give us a recommendation, something you think that would be really good and that people listening would enjoy reading. That's what we're doing here. But we're also here to ask people to support the station, and we want to take a minute to do that right now, talk a little bit about where we are now as we're really winding down the fundraising effort for this fall. We'll, as of, I think, about 7 o'clock tonight, we're going to pull a plug. We won't be asking for more money after that. We'll be getting back to our regular programming. But that makes it really important that if you've been thinking about it, if you've said, yes, I really do want to make a contribution, you don't wait, because the clock's running down on this fall fundraising effort. Jack Brighton is here with me in the studio. He's our guy who oversees our web operations.
Right. Now. And you can go to the web right now, willpledge.org. Just type it in your browser, and you can make an online contribution right now. Or you can use our pledge line in around Champaign-Urbana, 244-9455. And toll-free anywhere you can hear us. Where is that number? Darn it.
The toll-free line?
Yes, there is. Not, yes, it is. What is it?
866-779-9455.
Thank you very
much. It's right up there on the wall, but it's right behind you, so you can't really talk into the microphone and read off the wall at the same time.
I can barely talk into the microphone at the same time but at this point. But you know, one of the things I feel really proud about is the fact that we've got all these archives on our website. You know, something that I see a lot of people using. There's something like 170,000 podcast downloads that last month from WILL. A lot of people are getting our podcasts or going on our website and listening online, either live or the archives that have been up there. I don't know, since about year 2000, we've got just about every show up there. Mm-hmm. If that's something you use, you know, please understand that, you know, we're giving that stuff away. I mean, the point is we're not going to charge you for it. We're not going to make you log in and give a password and pay for a download, anything like that, because we feel this is public knowledge, it's public media, it's information that's important to share. We just give stuff away. What kind of business model is that anyway? I don't know, but it enriches the entire community. And the point is that then we come to you a couple times a year and say, hey, help us keep this going, not just for you, but for everybody with your pledge. 244-9455, that's the local number. Let's check in real fast with Martha Deal, one of our crack producers, who's there. And I think the phones are kind of silent at the moment, but how are we doing overall?
They are silent at the moment. However, since the last break, we have gone from $179,000 to $184,000. But back to my word of yesterday and today, momentum, we want to keep that going. We're still giving away books in this hour. And as one of the people who sometimes has to move those books to other places, I'd like to see people call in with a pledge and get one of those books. And we want to thank everyone who's called in. As you said, we value each and every listener, but there's a special group within that that we call members. And members make us happen. If you could give a dollar a day, that's $52 to help support WILM in a very real way. Helps bring you Focus 580, helps bring you the news, the BBC. Call 244-9455. The toll-free number, 866-779-9455. Or Jack Brighton's thing, online, willpledge.org. And it's really great sometimes when I'm working really hard and can't listen to the program to be able to go back and listen. So if you value, pick up the phone, get online, send us money, please.
Righto. And don't forget, you have just about maybe 25 minutes to get on the crazy book giveaway. So every pledge, you will get a free hardcover book. New from one of the publishers who sends us all these books in hopes that we'll do author interviews, which we do a lot of, either fiction or nonfiction. You choose. So make that pledge call right now, 244-9455. Go online to willpledge.org and get a free book.
All right. Thank you very much. And we have a caller here we'll bring into the conversation. People who are listening, if you want to call in and tell us about a book, you can certainly do that. And join our guests, Gail Walden and Carol Spindell. And let's talk with this person here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm going to turn this around. Have any of you read Vern Burton's new book, The Age of Lincoln, which was received a Chicago Heart Fund or something like that award? Just wondered if you guys had read it.
I read enough of it to do an hour interview with him. I thought it was very interesting. And you know, for me, when I interview writers, we have a lot of them on the show, and I try real hard to spend at least a couple of hours with the person's book. But that really means that I cannot, you know, people say to me, do you really read the books? And if I'm being honest, I'd have to say, well, not cover to cover, no. So I think we had a nice conversation. It's a very interesting book. It's worth, you know, worth some serious attention, not just me blowing through it at 100 miles an hour. So that interview, by the way, if you'd like to hear it, it's on our website. I'm sure that you could go back and catch it. I don't know that Carol and Gail, no, they're saying no, that they haven't.
Would like to, but haven't gotten to it yet.
No, but I heard a statistic that the best way to get your book sold is to either put Lincoln in the title or a dog. And I did see a dog. I have a book called The Dog of Lincoln, and I thought he had marketed it that exact way.
Caller, so you're saying you haven't read the book yet?
No. You're saying,
okay.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Others are welcome here to call 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I don't know where we are in the rotation. I think, you want to go, Carol?
Okay. I will quickly throw out another pair. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these, but, you know, I just want to remind readers out there, there are so many, many, many good writers who kind of never rise above. They don't get the media attention they deserve, and you probably haven't heard of them, and yet their books are just wonderful. And so I'd like to bring up one of those. Her name is Sandra Schofield. She's written, I believe, 7 novels. And her first novel was nominated for the National Book Award. But since then, I think a lot of people have not heard of her work. And it kind of goes along with this discussion of memoir. Why would one person write a memoir about their life and maybe someone else would write a novel? Or in the past, maybe privacy was viewed a little differently. People would have written a novel. And so Sandra Schofield, you can read a novel that she wrote called Plain Seeing, about growing up in Texas in a working class family, very Catholic. Her mother was a convert to Catholicism and died very young. And then you can read her memoir, which is called Occasions of Sin, again, about her real life, growing up working class, a very devout Catholic convert mother, who dies very young, I believe at 33, of Bright's disease, a disease of the liver, and leaves this teenage child trying to make sense of this. What, you know, especially some of the curious things that her mother did right before she died. Why did those things matter to her? And, of course, she will never know the answer, but she writes this memoir trying to figure it out. And she does have some very interesting and I would say very clear-eyed ideas about it. So if you're interested in that question of literary genre and want to read a memoir and novel by the same person, I won't say that it's exactly the same story, but it's very much parallel stories, I recommend Sandra Schofield. Occasions of Sin is the memoir, and Plain Seeing is the novel.
So are you suggesting people read it in any particular order? Would you say read one first, or does it matter?
I don't know if it really matters. You might want to read the memoir first, since that's closer to the true story, and then see what she does as a novelist. Uh-huh. That's the way I read it. I don't know. What do you think, Gail? I don't know. Do you think? I mean, either way, you're going to get different perceptions, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking of which way you would teach that.
Yeah.
You know, which would you bring to a student population about how things merge, and I think I would probably do the memoir first, right?
But either way,
you can do that either way that you like.
Yeah.
Well, okay, Gail, give us something else.
I'm going to talk about a couple poetry books because I don't think poetry gets a short shift in review. Although these are not just recently released, one was in 2003, and one I think 2005. One is called Into Perfect Spears, Such Holes Are Pierced, and it's by Catherine Burnett. And it really takes as its subject matter, two of her nieces were killed in a airplane crash and just disappeared. The airplane crash, I think it happened about 7 years ago, and it's a devastating loss. They're 9 and 11, and they were not with her sister. They were with her ex-husband. And it's just how she looks at the space loss and disappearance leaves is very interesting, but actually that's not one of the poems I'm going to read, because there's a series of them, and it actually is a narrative in the book about this sort of disappearance, but this is not. This is just called Son with Older Boys. Half men, half dressed, they play baseball with him on a summer field, and the more they hit at it, the more the plastic ball catbird of their games breaks. Half of it gone now and the light half gone too. Indisputable. Already he's 4, soon 5, I'm 40, soon 50, and it's evening now. Time to stop playing, and it's hopeless but beautiful how they wrap the ball in layers of masking tape until it looks like a half moon falling into and out of their game, which lasts a little longer now for their troubles.
Oh, very nice.
And the other one is by Tony Hoagland, and it's called What Narcissism Means to Me, which is one of my favorite titles. And I have to say, I was trying to find a short poem to read, but there were many poems that, even if they weren't too long, I could not, for the language, probably couldn't use them on the radio. And so I will give that caveat to readers. But Tony, who I actually went to graduate school with, he pushes a metaphor very far, usually, and he's very contemporary and very unusual with how far he will push a pun in language also. This is just called Migration. This year, Marie drives back and forth from the hospital room of her dying friend to the office of the adoption agency. I bet sometimes she doesn't know what the threshold she is waiting at, the hand of her sick friend, hot with fever, the theoretical baby, just a lot of paperwork so far. But next year, she might be standing by a grave wearing black with a splash of banana vomit on it. The little girl just starting to say Sesame Street and Cappuccino Latte Grande, Mommy. The future's ours for a while to hold with its heaviness and hope moving from one location to another like the Holy Ghost that it is.
Hmm. If people were interested in reading poetry, where do you go to find the books, or maybe find the name of someone that you might like to go and look for things that they have written? How do you know about this?
It's a problem. I mean, I think poetry, marketing and getting out, people do not read poetry in the same way they read other books. Pages for All Ages has a very good poetry section in this town. In Cambridge, there used to be a whole bookstore devoted to poetry called the Grolier Poetry Bookshop, and that was great. But basically, the university has readings of poetry that you could call the university bookstore here in town to find out. But yeah, basically, it's not something that newspapers really review, which is why I wanted to sort of bring out a couple of those things.
Sure. Yeah. Are there journals specifically devoted to poetry, and is it easy or difficult to get them if you really want to look at them?
Well, I think, well, Poetry Magazine is probably the prominent one, and that's up in Chicago, the Poetry Foundation, and they have been given a huge amount of money by one of their readers who rejected a lot of their poems, but she left them millions of dollars, and they have been able to do outreach. So they actually, I think, support on the PBS NewsHour, they support a poetry
sort of a continuing feature.
They interview poets, and the poets read usually on a tractor or something. The poets are usually in some scene that at least it's getting it out a little bit. You know, I think it's something we need to work at. I think there's a statistic that more people actually write poetry than read poetry. And
I think it's true. I certainly encounter it in my students. They all write poetry.
Yes.
But they're not reading the good contemporary poets that are out there I think they would love if they found them.
Or the masters. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that generations ago, poetry was actually taught and recited and taken more seriously than it is in contemporary education.
Well, and I'm sure that there probably people in as you go through school, you get some exposure to it, and I'm sure that there are various points in people's schooling where teacher says, "Or now we're going to write some," and people do that. But it's not the amount of time that's devoted to that kind of writing. It's probably certain compared with drama, which probably also doesn't get, people read Shakespeare and maybe read a few plays along the way. But mostly it's going to, as what Carol said, mostly it's going to be novels probably. Mm-hmm. Or in school, I guess, if you're expecting the students to read something, you better make it short. So maybe people are using stories to teach.
They do. They use a lot of short stories to teach. But yeah,
I should also say of the chain bookstores, Borders has shown some commitment to a poetry section. Also, they seem to be pretty.
Yeah. Good. Okay. We have a caller here. Why don't we talk with them? Someone in Gibson City on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
I want to recommend a new book. It's been published in June of 07 here. And the title is Meanwhile, a Biography of Milton Caniff. And he was the creator of Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. And this book would appeal a great deal to the we consider the greatest generation because they probably grew up enjoying those comic strips. And this book has been published this year because it's the centennial of Mr. Caniff's birth. And he asked the author to write his authorized biography. And the author is Robert C. Harvey.
And he lives in, or did live, I know he was getting ready to move. He lives in Champaign,
yes.
For a long time.
Right. He lived here about 40 years, and he and his wife, she just retired from the university, and they moved out to the Denver area where one of their daughters lives.
That's right. And he's actually been a guest on this program more than once to talk about comic art.
Right. So, and I've always enjoyed them.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
that's a
good recommendation. And I think, if you're interested in, and he certainly was a character who was, not only did he do this very popular comic strip, but he influenced a lot of other cartoonists. So he's like really been a father figure to a lot of other cartoonists.
Right. And the book is almost like an encyclopedia, too, giving so much information. And I have found it just fascinating. And I think that Bob Harvey is going to go out in October, later in October, for the centennial anniversary at his birth in Ohio. And so he's going to be speaking at the celebration, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just found it fascinating. I got mine at Pages.
All right. Well, thanks for the recommendation.
Okay.
I know it's interesting. But anybody who likes graphic art, it would be a good thing to take a look at.
Yes. Right. Well, Mr. Harvey does a lot about he's written a lot for comics and cartooning, too. So he's up to date on all of it.
All right. Well, thanks.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's talk to somebody else here. In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I haven't listened to your program before, so please tell me how often it's on the radio.
This program, Focus 580, is on Monday through Friday from 10 until noon.
No, I know that.
But this book thing, for a while now, we've been doing it when we've been raising money. And every once in a while, we have it when we're not, and we really shouldn't just do it when we're raising money. There is no regular time for it. It's just something that you'll have to kind of keep your ear to the ground, and when it's coming up, we'll try to mention it.
Okay. Well, I didn't even get into the beginning of today's program, but I wondered if anybody had talked about Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, P-O-L-L-A-N. The subtitle is A Natural History of Four Meals, and it tells a lot about corn and how corn is used in everything. And he tells how the corn is processed and which ways it's used and how difficult it was to have a completely vegetarian meal without any corn in it and stuff like that. I've only read half of it. It was published last year, 06. But it's not really a memoir, but it sure tells about how he tracked the corn. He bought a steer and tried to keep track of how the corn went from the field to his steer and then to the feedlot and then to the packing plant and then to hamburger. And then he tried to have natural foods, and he did some, I think, scavenging in the national parks in California to try to find mushrooms or something so that he could eat a natural food. And he talked about going to a natural food farm. Okay, then another new one is Once Upon a Country, and the subtitle of that is A Palestinian Life. The author is Sari, S-A-R-I, and that's a man. And I don't know how you pronounce the last name, N-U-S-S-E-I-B-E-H.
It's Nusebe. It's kind of like what it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was published this year. It's a huge book, and here again, I've only gotten partway through it, 170. But he talks about philosophy, and he studied, he's a Palestinian, and he studied in Oxford in England and read philosophy, and then he talks about going back to Palestine and how life in Palestine changed with after the Six-Day War and some of the other stuff. But it's, here again, it's memoir, but it's history, and it surely gives a much different viewpoint of that part of the country than anything I've read before.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the books, I think, sound very daunting, but they're very interestingly written, and this Omnivore's Dilemma is I just wanted to keep reading. Okay.
Well, thanks. Thank you. Well, thanks for the recommendations.
Yeah.
Both authors, by the way, have been on this show, and the interviews, I'm sure, are on the website if you want to go back and listen to them. I think they're both very interesting books. Certainly Michael Pollan's gotten lots of attention for that book.
And I think that book is having a big influence. It's on the New York Times bestseller list now, and I run into a lot of people who've read it. I read it this summer. The writing is beautiful. But I think it's also having a big influence. He talks a lot about the industrial organic industry, and that's a really interesting part of it. Talks about the corn surplus, which we certainly know about in this part of the country, and how that's affecting the kind of foods people eat. And it's wide-ranging. He's terrific at synthesizing information and yet putting it into a flowing narrative. And yeah, I think it is a thick book. I know what the caller means about it being a little daunting, but it is also very readable because the prose is so lovely and so flowing.
Yeah, so that's Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. Does it have one L or two?
P-O-L-L-A-N, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, all right. We have about 5 minutes left here. I want to make sure that we get in at least some more recommendations. Gail, you want to give us something else?
I was just going to talk about a couple. I went to the Obituary Writers Conference in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
I did write about it.
And
there
it's
is
on,
a conference of obituary? Yes,
there is. And a lot of people from Britain come in from it. It's a very small group because we don't really have papers that hire obituary writers anymore. But the British take their obituaries very seriously, and they are at the height of the art form. And actually, I think you have interviewed this woman before, Marilyn Johnson.
Celeste, I think she was on the Afternoon Magazine.
Okay.
Yes.
The Deadbeat, who sort of wrote about this group of obituary writers and obituary fans who do come together once a year. And it's a really interesting, fun book. I have to say, when I was looking up Grace Paley's British obituary, because I know to go to those papers, usually the New York Times also, and the Atlanta Journal has very good obituary writers, but there was a little thing saying this obituary has been updated after the obituary writer died in 1993. So people keep, which
they're
is
on
very,
file.
They're on file. So somebody can write it and not be around to fill in the other things, which is very interesting. But they at the conference, they pass around things, and Marilyn has this in The Deadbeat about just things that were quotes from obituaries, actual obituaries that were sent in from funeral homes. And they're very funny people, although they tend to drink a lot, the obituary writers, I've noticed. But one of them was City of Residence, Bend, Oregon, Cause of Death, Bend, Oregon. And another one I kind of liked. She used to scratch beautiful flowers and scenes on colored Easter eggs. With a simple paring knife, she knitted over 50 Afghans for her family and friends in just the last 5 years.
Must be a period missing there.
Yeah, I think some of them are punctuation, but some of them, anyway. And so some of those kind of things are in that. And then Jim Sheeler, who won a Pulitzer Prize for following around some of the people. He works for the Denver Rocky News as a feature writer, and he follows home men coming from Iraq and the people who have to tell the families. Oh, that is not in this book, but this is a collection of his obituaries. He's one of the top obituary writers in the country, and mostly ordinary lives, inspiring stories of ordinary people who led extraordinary lives. And they're just ordinary people in Colorado. Mm. And the book's called Obit.
So I suppose the part of the appeal here is that what we're talking about is a really short biography. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, you know, if you only have a few paragraphs, what are you going to decide to say?
What is going to come out? Yeah. It's a very interesting art form, I think. It's just not practiced very much here. But it is. It's the last thing you say about a person's life, and you have a limited amount of words to say it in. Mm-hmm. And to distill that life is...
It's a challenge,
huge challenge. And this woman in Atlanta, I mean, they talk about things about how you talk about suicide in obituaries, and also the fact that women do not get the same amount of space on obituary pages for prominent ones as men. And so there's like a movement to make women's obituaries more prominent in certain papers. And I think that Deadbeat book deals with a lot of those issues.
Mm, okay. Carol, you want to mention one more thing?
Okay, I'll just put in one more plug. I know a lot of people are caught up with World War II right now. Maybe they're on a roll with the Ken Burns thing, so I thought that would be a fun topic. And I wanted to put in a plug for Suite Française by Irene Nemirovsky. I'm sure a lot of people have read it. There's a fascinating story behind this book. She was a well-known French novelist. She was Jewish but had converted to Catholicism, but was deported and sent to Auschwitz and died. And years later, her two daughters survived. And many, many years later, they picked up what they thought was a kind of journal and thought it would have been too painful for them to read in a suitcase that somehow survived the war, and found the first two sections of a very complex novel she was writing. And it is extraordinary. Unfortunately, it is a work in progress. We do not have the final section. She couldn't complete it. But what is so interesting, it's like a time capsule. Because had she survived the war, I don't think she would have written about June when the Germans are marching toward Paris the way she does. But it's very modern in feeling. Of course, that was the height of modernism. And she follows all these different people as they flee Paris, and all their little foibles and all their little concerns, and they have no idea what's about to hit them. And it is really extraordinary reading.
All right. Well, you know, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop. I'm really sorry we don't have more time. We really should do this again and do it when we're not going to have to take time out for asking for money. I want to thank you both very much, Gail.
Thanks, David.
And Carol, for being here.
Pleasure.
You can look
for
Gail's reviews in the Sun-Times, and also go and look for her book, Same Blue Chevy. That's it.
That's
her poetry collection. And also Carol's books, Dancing in Halftime and The Sacred Grove. Thanks to both of you for being here. And you can look on our website for the books that they have recommended and also those from the first hour.